You're listening to Slice of Cheese with Jenny Linford on Food FM. Enhance your cheese board with Peter's Yard sourdough crackers this Christmas. Available at Waitrose, Sainsbury's, Morrison's, Ocado, Amazon, petersyard.com and specialist food retailers.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.
Hello, welcome to A Slice of Cheese, the Food FM radio series that celebrates the world of cheese. I'm Jenny Linford, a food writer and cheese enthusiast, the author of Great British Cheeses. Cheeses are delicious and fascinating food, and we're setting out to explore this remarkable food and share the stories of the people who make, sell and love it. This week on A Slice of Cheese, we explore the vocabulary of cheese, the words used within the cheesemaking world, and this is the language we use to describe the cheese we eat. I talked to Hero Hirsch, head of retail at Paxton Whitfield, Charlie Turnbull, a founding director of the Academy of Cheese, and cheese writer Patrick McGuigan, author of The Philosophy of Cheese.
Online, on smart speakers, and on Listen Again, this is Food FM.
Enhance your cheese board with Peter's Yard sourdough crackers this Christmas. Available at Waitrose, Sainsbury's, Morrison's, Ocado, Amazon, petersyard.com, and specialist food retailers.
This week on A Slice of Cheese, very happy to have with me today Hero Hirsch, head of retail at the wonderful cheesemonger Paxton Whitfield. Good morning, Hero.
Morning, Jenny.
And Hero, as well as your, I imagine, very demanding job, you also teach for the Academy of Cheese, which is relevant to why I wanted you on this programme. We're exploring this week, we're looking at the idea of vocabulary of cheese, she said, trying to say it properly and struggling. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about the cheese terms that people in the cheese world use and trying to unpick them. And I thought it'd be really useful to have you on this episode because I always think you're very good at explaining things very clearly. Yeah. And I wanted to sort of focus on the cheesemaking aspect. I mean, I realise you're not a cheesemaker, but you have to, but as a cheesemonger, you have to understand what's happened, don't you? You
know? And definitely part of the academy teaching that we do is all around this glossary of cheesemaking terms and kind of explaining what they are.
When people start making cheese, they add what are called starter cultures. Mm-hmm. And again, I think that is quite a baffling term to a lot of people.
The most baffling term to the uninitiated, certainly. And it is a rather complex subject, starter culture. So I'm going to keep it as absolutely top level
simple
as I can. Yeah.
Perfect.
So starter cultures are added to cheese making at the very beginning of the cheese. So you'll add them to the milk at the very beginning of cheese making. And it will be a mix of acidifying and ripening cultures. So it'll be a cocktail of bacteria, and they're responsible for all sorts of things throughout the cheese, which is why I say they're complicated. So they give flavour, they introduce moulds which, you know, have an effect on the cheese as it matures. You can, if anyone's sort of interested in starter cultures, you can buy them online, and you can, you know, go to cheesemaking shops and you can see exactly what's likely to happen if you add a packet of these particular cultures to milk. So there'll be, you know, you can buy Gorgonzola in a sort of freeze-dried packet almost.
Right.
And that's one way that starter cultures are introduced. Another way that starter cultures are introduced, which is more natural. So, and this, I think, makes more sense when we talk about starter cultures like we do about, you know, sourdough starters. Mm-hmm. Is that they would take a proportion of the whey from the previous day's make and create starter cultures from that. So you're using like a continuous whey starter. Yeah. And I think that tends to be the point where people can really connect this to other starters that they know of, such as in bread making.
Yes, and keeping this whole process of continual usage and taking a part of what you made and using it again. Okay, so what happens to the milk, you know, which is a liquid, to get it to a solid cheese? Well, one of the things that happens is the addition of rennet. So perhaps you could tell us what rennet is, Hero.
Sure. So rennet is a coagulant. So what we mean by a coagulant is when we add the rennet to our liquid milk, it will change it from a liquid into a solid. So it'll change it from one big sort of vat of liquid milk into one basically enormous lump of milk jelly called junket. And so it comes from a few different sources. And I think rennet is definitely something we talk about on the counter a lot, because we talk about traditional rennet and vegetarian rennet. So there are two quite different sources. Right. Which will affect, I guess, who will eat the cheese, if they have dietary restrictions or not. Traditional rennet comes from the fourth stomach of a ruminant, so normally from a kid, calf or lamb, depending on whether you're making a cow, sheep or goat's cheese. And it contains an enzyme which is responsible for turning liquid into solid. And there's a very good reason for that in terms of milk-fed animals, is that that will turn the milk that they are drinking into something which is digestible and into the solids. And so we use this enzyme from the stomach of the animal in order to coagulate milk. So that's the very traditional.
If you think of cheese making, which is, you know, an ancient, something that we have done, you know, for centuries, it would have been people were using strips from, because it was a byproduct, really, wasn't it, of the dairy product. They'd have the calves, they would use bits of the stomach. I mean, this makes people feel slightly queasy, but it's a very practical use of a resource.
There's this sort of, you know, myth about how it was discovered, if they were using like a stomach to transport liquids, and then suddenly realised that transporting their milk had turned into something solid, but also something delicious. So, you know, there are various kind of myths around like how potentially this was discovered. And there are still some producers out there who, you know, rather than using like a sort of, they often, the way it's used is sort of turned into like a tea almost. So they brew up the stomach with liquid, and then you'll use a few drops of that. There are still some producers out there who would just put strips of stomach directly into the vat with the milk. Right. Which I'm sure is much harder to measure.
Yeah, yeah, fascinating. And then, of course, you mentioned vegetarian rennet, so this is a later arrival. Oh, is it, actually?
Two different types. So there's vegetable rennet, so vegetables, so all sorts of different vegetables which are used to have the same coagulating effect on milk. So thistles are probably the most widely used in sort of Spain and Portugal, is very traditional. But all sorts of other things that have been used through history, like ivy leaves, capers, nettles, pineapple even, mushrooms. But yeah, thistle is probably the best known vegetable rennet in use today. Yes, exactly.
Which is such a great name, I think. It's such a great word. I love it. Yes.
And then we have the other type of vegetarian rennet, which I won't go too far into, but they emerged in the 1970s and the 1980s. And so with advances in technology as to how we can synthesize rennet, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it is interesting because I think, you know, one of the things that in these episodes of cheese, when you were talking to cheesemakers, if the cheese are protected by law, sometimes that area of protection about how it's made will stipulate the type of rennet. So, for example, Parmigiano Reggiano cannot be vegetarian, can it? Because they use a traditional rennet.
Absolutely correct. And not all PDOs, so the protected food names, not all of them will stipulate the whether the rennet is vegetarian or not. But certainly some of them, it's seen as an important part of the character of the cheese to the point where they have protected that into the recipe.
Right, brilliant. OK, moving on. So basically you talked about how, you know, the milk's been turned into a junket, and you talked about that process of coagulation, curdling the milk. And then, so I suppose perhaps one thing we should talk about, what the cheesemaker's looking for, is to separate the curds from the whey. And I put those two terms together because they sort of go together. Perhaps you can tell us what those are. Those are, Hero.
Yeah, absolutely. So once after you've got the large lump of milk jelly, you want to start releasing the liquid from that. So you're going to start making cuts into the curd. Depending on what type of cheese you make, you will keep the curds either larger or you'll cut them smaller if you're making a harder cheese. And as you cut into that, you'll start to separate the curds and the whey. So there'll be a liquid that all of the little bit lumps of solid are floating in. That liquid is the whey. Mm-hmm. And then the solid is the curds. And the curds are really the bit that we need to capture to make most cheeses.
Yes, very true. And as you say, I mean, this is the, we won't get into it, but then from their many, many ways of treating the curd and working with it to, you know, to hence, you know, so many different types of cheeses out there in the world. And I mean, and the whey is interesting, isn't it? Because the whey has quite a lot of protein still in it, hasn't it? And so there is the tradition also of making, of using that whey to make cheeses. Perhaps tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so there's a couple of, I suppose, the most famous whey cheeses. So the first one would be ricotta, whereby it is, ricotta I think means recooked.
It does,
whey is heated again, and all of the proteins remaining are then skimmed off as little lumps. There's a Norwegian style of making whey cheeses in things like Gjetost or Brunost, which is a brown cheeses, where the whey is really cooked down and caramelised until it creates an almost fudgy sort of product.
That's a good word for it, yes.
So those are a couple of the whey cheeses which are made, but whey has lots of other uses outside of cheese making, even at that stage. And as you would hope, it doesn't go to waste. So quite often it is fed to pigs, which kind
of
creates
that lovely link, isn't there? Yes.
Yeah, so I think things I know like ham and parmesan, you have this symbiotic relationship between the two products and the animals.
Because the pigs are fed with the whey from the parmesan and cheese making. So that is a very practical and sort of satisfying use, the two, as you say, brilliant.
Perhaps less satisfying but more widespread is the use of the whey protein to make protein powders, so for bodybuilders.
Right, good point.
And there was a point, I believe, that almost overtook cheese making in terms of how lucrative it is, that the whey would be more valuable than the cheese in some cases.
That is quite an irony here.
At scale, whey protein is a really important part of that economy.
Right. Wow. Fascinating. I mean, a term that I've come across with is lactic curd cheeses. We won't go into every type of cheese we've made. We'll never stop talking here. But I mean, could you tell me a little bit about that? Explain, because I think that's slightly baffling to people.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're just going to take a couple of steps back, because lactic set curd is a different way of curdling milk to rennet. Mm-hmm. It has quite a similar effect in some ways, but it's a different method. So when you are making cheese, you have milk. Rather than adding rennet, which is an enzyme that turns the milk into a big solid, lactic coagulation is a much, much slower process, whereby you are building acidity in the milk until it almost becomes so acidic it denatures it. Capitulates and it starts to clump together. And we've all done this, I think, when we've left milk in our fridge for too long at the start of our careers as lactic cheesemakers. Normally starts with a pint of milk in the fridge being there too long. So it's this very, very slow build of acidity which changes the nature of the milk and causes it to clump.
I didn't mean to interrupt, but when I made paneer, that's exactly what Rupa, who was telling me how to make paneer, that's what she says. Take some milk. You know, you sort of want the soured milk because you want that process to have started before you, which you then amplify it by, in paneer's case, by adding lemon juice, I think.
So. Yes. Yeah, lactic set cheeses, it will be a fairly slow process. I think probably the best known lactic set cheeses will be families like fresh French goat's milk cheeses. Are quite often made that way in things like Langres. Because you're creating a different type of curd to when you use a rennet, it's a little bit more fragile, it's more sort of crumbly and delicate, and so it tends to be used just for small format cheeses. So when you French goat cheeses as a group, they tend to be these sort of small formats, sort of between 100 and maybe up to maybe 300 grams. And because they're made with this very delicate curd, if you tried to make a large format cheese with a lactic curd, it would be too crumbly, it would fall apart.
Right. That's a very interesting practical point about why cheese is coming different sizes, isn't it? Fascinating. Now, thinking about the actual curd, because we've talked about the whey, one of the things that can happen to curd is it can be milled. Tell us about milling.
Well, this is a process which is probably more associated with hard cheeses. So after the curd's been cut and drained, you'll have these sort of big slabs of curd, and you'll put them through a mill. So it may be like a chip mill it's a little bit like a potato chipper. Mm-hmm. You put the curd in, it comes out in sort of even-sized chips, or you might go for something that really sort of crumbles the cheese and kind of re-crumbles it, basically.
Uh-huh. Right.
And this just helps with like the even distribution of salt. So it's the point in the hard cheese make where you're going to add salt to the curd, and you want a nice even sort of crumb, I suppose, in your curd that you can then mix the salt into fairly evenly. So it just assures that you have a nice even-sized pieces.
Right, OK. I was thinking of moulding and pressing. These are sort of, again, these are further on, I suppose, in the cheese process. Or, yeah, you know, we've moved away from the vat, haven't we? We're working with the curd.
Yeah, some of the last stuff that you're going to do before maturation, I suppose.
Yeah.
So moulding is the point at which the cheese quite literally takes shape. So the size and the shape will be defined by what size mould you put it into.
Right.
So the curds will be heaped into moulds, which will allow for some drainage. They normally have little holes in them. Sometimes they look like little colanders or little baskets. And that really does define the size, the shape, the imprint on the outside of the rind. Certainly there's some cheeses where they have very famous very recognisable imprints, I should say, things like Burkswell or Manchego, sort of herringbone pattern. That's all put there by the cheese being pressed into the mould.
Right. And you mentioned pressing, which is, well, in fact, was my other word. So pressing. So tell us what is pressing doing to the curd? And what does it do? Yeah, what's its
purpose? Because a lot of cheeses, you don't need to press them. They just let gravity work on them. So soft cheeses don't tend to be pressed. It's really something that's kind of reserved for hard cheese makes. So after they've been put into the mould, sometimes they're stacked on top of each other, or sometimes they're put directly into a press. And it is normally a sort of hydraulic press, and so it will apply a certain amount of pressure onto each cheese, which tends to increase. And what this does is it just expels the sort of final amount of whey, and it helps the curds in the cheese to sort of knit together.
Right.
So, it's always associated with firmer cheeses. Things like Toms and Goudas would be subject to pressing.
And as we were talking here, I did think of one term which is not to do with cheese making, but I think I've noticed it comes up a lot when I talk to people in the cheese world. And this is this term PDO. What do you want to unpick that for people? What does it mean?
Yeah, sure. Well, PDO is one of the terms which is used to describe protected food names. So PDO literally stands for Protected Designation of Origin. There are other protected food names, so PGI is another one. TSG is another. PDO is probably the best known and probably one of the strictest ones. And it's basically a scheme which is applied to protect recipes and traditions around not just cheese making, but other foods as well.
Yes, and drink, yes.
Yeah. What it really does, a PDO, is it ties a region to a recipe. So if you want to use the name of a cheese which is named after a region, there will be certain specifications, and these are all held on file by the EU, or there'll be a sort of harmonised scheme in the UK. And it will specify certain things about how that, in this case, cheese is made. So maybe around, as you say, the rennet, whether it's traditional or vegetarian, pasteurised or unpasteurised milk, sometimes the breed of animal which is being used, or the radius in which the food can be produced to feed the animal. So you really do have a sort of historical record for each of these products, but also a tie to a specific region.
Brilliant. Oh, Hira, that was fascinating. I mean, it was very lucid. Thank you. Which is exactly what I wanted. So thank you for taking the time to talk to us. Hira, thank you very much.
Oh, my absolute pleasure.
Online, on smart speakers, and on Listen Again. This is Food FM.
This week on A Slice of Cheese, very happy to have with me today Charlie Turnbull, one of the founders of the Academy of Cheese, and someone who is a trainer of cheese, both the professional world and the general public. So a lot of cheese knowledge. Good morning, Charlie.
Good morning.
Charlie, this week on A Slice of Cheese, we're exploring the idea of the cheese vocabulary, the words that we use to talk about cheese. So in a way, I wanted to talk to you about two aspects of your work. I thought perhaps we could start with cheese judging. I know you're a very you do a lot of judging. And I was really interested because presumably, in a way, there has to be a shared vocabulary. If you know, if you're trying to reach a decision about the merits or demerits of a cheese, you have to have the words to use. Is that something you've seen evolve, or do you think there are issues with that?
The short answer is yes and yes. Yes, we need a shared vocabulary. And yes, I've seen it evolve. And yes, it's a problem or a challenge or something that we need to, you know, to work with. When you work as a judge, you're never alone, usually in pairs, twos, threes or fours. And often the first two or three cheeses you're judging, you're feeling each other out as much as the cheeses out. You're going, right, how are we going to do this? Where are we going to put our emphasis? What are our needs here? And the vocabulary has to sort of step up quite quickly, which is why when you're working with experienced judges, it's easier. And when you're working with inexperienced judges, it takes a bit longer.
And is that, so literally, would you find yourself, if you were working with somebody who was a novice cheese judge, would you, which I'm guessing may happen, that an experienced judge gets paired with somebody who isn't?
All the time.
Right. So then do you have to sort of...
I want to make clear, these people are often professionals in a separate way. You know, I'd be working with a technical person or a chef or something like that. So it's this multidisciplinary element of language which needs to be considered as well. You know, chefs will use terms in a different way to where, you know, a cheese professional might. So there's a bit of jockeying to try and make sure you're on the same page.
Yeah, that's interesting. And would you find yourself explaining, you know, are there terms that you might use or, you know, and someone would just be sort of, and that might be a bit of a revelation to someone who's not from that world, not from the cheese world?
I think explaining has rather a bad rep at the moment. let's say I travel with them to find a common outcome. Yes, there's always some way you've got to get to a place where you're both talking the same language. And cheese language, or fruit language in general, is very complex. You find that within food describing, there's a very, very professional level and established use within corporates, usually within, you know, the academic level, academic area, where language has specific meaning. And they have a lexicon, and different institutions will have their own lexicon, which they adopt. And the words have very, you know, they're very clear meaning, and they will attach to each of those words. You'll often have a scale. So if you say it's moosey, is it moosey 0 or moosey 10 or moosey 5? And so there is at one end of the spectrum, there's a pedanticism that is a necessary sort of extra of that professionalism. But
yeah.
At the other end of the scale, you've got what you might call consumer language, tends to be more subjective, maybe more general. There's a lot of wooliness between, you know, words like creamy and nice, you know, things that can be interpreted in different ways. Those are a challenge. But, you know, we do this all the time, so it's not a challenge that we're not completely capable of overcoming. But you just need to settle into the language so everyone knows what they're talking about.
And over the years that you've been judging, Charlie, do you ever see new words enter that lexicon? You know, or has it already been sort of set in the cheese world when you're judging? Is there a sort of set vocabulary that experienced judges would be using?
But not all competitions are equal. So probably the most substantially academic in its style is probably the American Cheese Society judging, where they actually have two judging pathways. One is a technical side, and one is what you might call an organoleptic or a more subjective side. And these, in those environments, you are absolutely required to understand the language. They release the lexicon out beforehand. You're supposed to know it, you're supposed to have read it, you have to memorize it to a broad degree. But then, you know, the other inspection, there's judging at, you know, maybe a local cheese awards for a regional county show. And those people are just consumer pluses. Now, that is actually what the competition wants. They want a consumable, relatable outcome, if you excuse me.
Yes.
So it's not just about the language being specific. It's about the language being appropriate to the users of the words, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, that's a very good point, isn't it? Yes, what's it there for? What purpose does it serve? Brilliant. And I was really interested, I was thinking about the Academy of Cheese, which is this, you know, which is such an impressive organisation trying to spread cheese knowledge,
cheese knowledge. I'm very impressed myself.
And I always, and so when, you know, and it's a, you know, you're relatively young as an institution in the cheese world in Britain. When that was set up, did you then have to come up, you know, with a vocabulary, again, you know, perhaps with a lexicon in a way that you would be teaching to the people who want to learn about cheese?
Oh, without question. So, but I wouldn't say we've completed our journey at all in this area. So within the Academy of Cheese, the agenda is to allow the door open for the people with the least knowledge of cheese. And that's where we started. So the principles of our first teaching material is that it has to be jargon-free, or at least jargon that's enjoyable to learn. So as you learn, you pick up words, you pick up understanding. And our first sort of major step into that space was to create what we call the structured approach to tasting cheese, which doesn't sound like a language, but what it does is it takes you through all the aspects of cheese. We have the first stage, which we call observations, which are is basically before you taste it, what does it look like, why does it prod it, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then you move on to the taste and flavour, and that's when you actually put it in your mouth. And taste and flavour is an interesting one, because taste and flavour we use in the consumer space very interchangeably. You know, tasting notes, which sort of encapsulates anything that might be about cheese.
Yeah.
In academia, taste and flavour are quite distinct. Taste is what happens in your mouth, and flavour is what happens in your nose. And the sensory arrays in each space are really different. They have very different outcomes, very different purposes. And so you quickly butt up against formal language.
That's really interesting that those words flavour and taste are often used interchangeably, but actually they mean something different. What tell us a little bit more, just so people understand. So taste, fruit, let's start with that.
Let's start with the fact that there isn't, in academic use, taste and flavour are distinct, and I'll come on to why they're distinct second, but vast majority of us are not academics. So to say that they're different words and have different meanings is to disrespect the fact that we all use them interchangeably, and that's right in those circumstances. And trying to present language as alienating or describe some people wrong because they're misusing it is inappropriate in my experience. You know, we need more people to pay more attention to more food so that they're getting more from their food and enjoying it more. We've got to go to them when we use language, not expect them to come to us. Mm-hmm. And I feel very strongly about that. And that's a core element of the Academy of Cheese, is that we're here to serve you. Our language is here to serve you, the ordinary person, the person who's doing it for their jollies or wants to improve in their career, whatever. The language must serve. You are not a servant to language. But within that, there are conventions. And within academic circles, taste and flavour are distinct, and the taste is what happens in your mouth. And that is the five classic tastes of sweet, salt, savoury, acid, and bitter. And when I say savoury, another word people use a lot is umami, which is a sort of more academic word. And there you have another example. Umami, Japanese word for deliciousness, first used in the sort of second decade of the last century, and didn't really get adopted by Western academic sources, let alone Western, general use, until the latter end, sort of 1990s. And now is seen pretty embedded in cooks and, the food use universe.
Yes.
But you ask a person into the street what umami means, and they'll go, they'll hesitate. And there's a problem with that, because umami is clearly not a Latin-sourced word, a European-sourced word, and that's a bit scary to people, which is why the Academy has chosen to use the word savoury, which is an approximation. It is not a direct match,
right?
But it makes it more accessible, and that's a common problem with language, making it useful and making it specific. And this is a challenge we come up against all the time. So that's taste.
Yeah.
And you're going to go, well, what else is there? Well, of course, everything else is enormous. You know, there's sage and oranges and, cow shit and lavender. Yeah. There's millions and millions of flavours. And that happens through your nose. And that is a type of smelling. It's called retronasal sensing. And that language is really interesting, because that is an experiential library, right? What do I mean by that? It means that you didn't get born with any of those nasal flavours. You didn't get born going, I know what lavender is. It means you've built it up over your lifetime by smelling lavender on several occasions. And your nose goes, right, I've got these 20 chemicals in my nose, and experience tells me that collectively that means lavender. Right. So flavor itself is a language we've had to learn from food into the nasal experience, the flavor. And then we have to do the second step of turning that into something we vocalize. So within the language of flavor, we actually need to know two languages. We need the language of all the possible smells in the world and the language of being able to name them and talk about them.
Right. That's quite a challenge.
It is. I mean, academics disagree, but most people, there are at least 10,000 potential smells that you could eat, smells and flavors. Others will tell you there are literally millions, because there are 400 senses in your nose and they do not act individually. So if sensor one 32 and 400 go off, that's different from 132 and 322, if you see what I mean.
I'm now going to cut this for sure.
But it's but they are, so that those chemicals form sentences of their own, if you see what I mean.
So they
have a series of chemical triggers that form a little sentence, and there's emphasis on the sentence. So if this chemical has got more of it, or it's in the context of another chemical, the brain will go, hang on, pay more attention to that one. So the language of a language of flavour is very similar to the physical experience of flavour.
Right. That's interesting. So when you are teaching, Charlie, let's suppose you've started with people who, you know, who are not from the cheese world, but they want to learn about cheese, you know, that's at the Academy of Cheese. Is one of the things that you go on, is it a journey where perhaps at the end they have found a shared vocabulary to describe what they're tasting?
So initially we aren't really hung up on what they experience, because this is another challenge for us. In the same way as we'll have different languages, we physically experience flavours in a different way, flavours and tastes.
Yeah.
So we can't expect people to eat the same piece of cheese and say the same things, even if they have the same language. They've got to they've got to find their own way through their experience. And you know, if you've only had experience of lavender and never of marjoram, marjoram might come up your nose and you're just going to let it go because it's not there for you. You've never, it's totally outside your experience. It's like meeting a word, you don't know what it means.
Yeah.
And he goes, well, that's fine, but someone's going to have to explain that to me. You know, and so flavours themselves are, so in our first two levels of the Academy of Cheese, it's really about talking to each other and talking to cheese and finding any words, trying to find space. And we give them a flavour map. So we have a series of what we think of as bundles, which are dairy, animal, fungal or fermented, mineral or chemical, fruity or floral, and vegetable or herbaceous, which gathers the flavours into little parcels that allows people to go, hang on a second, this is a bit fruity. So they go over to the fruity area and they start looking down the different types of fruit. And this is what's really interesting about language, is its connection, right? So you've got that and you go, I don't know what that is. Oh, it says strawberry. That, you know, it is strawberry. And they go, and the other guy goes, are you sure it's not raspberry? And then you talk to each other, is it strawberry, is it raspberry? And then you go, I think it's right. Then you agree. And so the process of experience is really enabled by having language, even if it's wrong, if you see what I mean. It's about bouncing ideas.
It's a starting point. Yeah, yeah. Brilliant. It gives a framework in a way for when then you can exchange some thoughts.
Yeah. And you are not, as a judge, you're never allowed to judge alone. People aren't good enough on their own. They just never are. So judging is a very much collaborative process. And the process of talking is as important as the language and the words used. So that give and take, that evolution of an experience together, and you're shaping it between you.
One of the things, you know, we've talked all about taste and flavour because I asked you about it, but I was also thinking about texture, because for me that's such a, you know, that's such a rich thing that cheese offers, is this array of textures. And in a funny, and that was very interesting when you said about there would be moussiness, but different levels of moussiness. I thought that's really interesting because you know, I myself would just use these words, you know, to describe an array, the same word to describe a cheese that has a lot of different textures. So, yeah, I mean, that's really interesting. So is that something that you also discuss at the Academy of Cheese?
It is. And actually, that bit is almost more difficult to pin down because there isn't the high level of textural vocabulary that there is with taste and flavour. Everyone talks about taste and flavour all the time. So, you know, there's a nice little sort of family tree. You can have fruits, but then you can have red berries, and then you can have strawberries. And you can go down a pathway and narrow it down as much as you like. But with textures, you don't have that. You literally just have a series of textures, and it's one of them, if you see what I mean.
So it doesn't
naturally fall into families in the sort of, I mean, you have very generic words like soft and hard or elastic or something like that. But actually, the sort of spreadable and moussey and butter-like, you know, these are all textures which immediately bring something to mind, but they sort of have things in common, but also they're quite different. Do you see what I mean?
I do totally see what you mean. I mean, that's what's so, yeah, quite. I mean, it really is sort of, if you think about that world of, you know, which you call soft cheese, but then within it, you know, the array of textures that you can find, because some of them are so sort of light and delicate and sort of marshmallowy, you know, fluffy, and then others are very, yeah, sort of soft and melting and yielding. So, yeah, wow, okay, yeah.
But within that, you also get, there are examples of where there are technical terms in the cheese making community which a cheese lover would need to learn towards. Not so straight away, mechanical openings. That just sounds weird, like you've got a digger or something like and actually, it's a very specific experience of the texture of cheese, which how it's come out of the press, effectively. And so you can see where cheeses haven't been properly pressed and where cheeses have been properly pressed. And you talk about mechanical openings. You know, when you talk about eyes, for instance, the shape of the eye is terribly important because that can lean you towards how the eye was produced, whether it's appropriate and a whole bunch of things like that. So it's not, even though the general words are good, sometimes you do fall over the line into what you might call professional speak. And one has to be aware of that. If someone is using professional speak and is unaware of it, they could easily missay, and it's not their fault.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, we often use that term jargon as a, you know, dismissively, because it's seen as a barrier. But jargon is there, you know, within a world. People have jargon because it's their world and it's describing things that they learn, they know about. It reflects, you know, I suppose it's best, it's a level of expertise, isn't it, and knowledge, and that you have this a specific vocabulary to talk about whatever it is. So I think what's really good, which seems to be what you're saying, is that you wouldn't want to use jargon and sort of alienate people, but you want to explain it.
Yeah. I mean, we mustn't ever lose sight of the fact that cheese is supposed to be a joy, you know, and that, you know, people try with great extent to use language to explain what you might call the objective truth of cheese, if you could put it that way. But you can do that all you like. You know, you've got to come back at some way and meet them on a subjective level, because that's what we're doing it for. That's why we choose it. That's why we spend time and money on cheese. It is not about it being purely nutritious. So one's got to make sure that that language is available too, not just the jargon.
I mean, it goes back to that subjectivity of, you know, as you said, we taste individually. And, you know, I've interviewed, you know, many great food producers and experts, and there's often people being very intimidated, have a sense that, you know, there's a right whiskey to buy. But when I've talked to these great people in the world, they just go, you know, Jenny, you know, buy what you like. You know, it's what you like, what you enjoy drinking. You know, you might not like a vintage whiskey. It might be too woody, you know, too long in cask for you. But so you might enjoy something. That's fine. You know, there's actually, that's sort of it in a way, isn't it? That actually, you know, food and drink and cheese, of course, you know, for me, offers huge pleasures. And really, that's the starting point, isn't it?
It's the starting point and it's the end point. You know, you get into it because you're enjoying it. And at the end of the day, you're using language and learning the language or improving your language so you can enjoy it more.
Wonderful. Well, I think that's the perfect note to stop. Thank you, Charlie. That was fascinating. Thanks for your time. Much appreciated.
A pleasure.
I'm a huge fan of Peter's Yard's crackers, and they always feature on my Christmas cheese board. All Peter's Yard's crackers are made in small batches using quality natural ingredients and their sourdough starter, slowly fermented for 16 hours for award-winning flavour and crunch. Visit petersyard.com/shop, enter the code SLICEOFCHEESE at the checkout to receive 25% off your first order.
Online, on smart speakers and on Listen Again, this is Food FM.
Enhance your cheese board with Peter's Yard sourdough crackers this Christmas. Available at Waitrose, Sainsbury's, Morrison's, Ocado, Amazon, petersyard.com and specialist food retailers.
Before we go on exploring the world of cheese, here's news of another Food FM programme that I think you'd really enjoy.
Thank you, Jenny. Well, I'm David, the host of The Drinking Hour here on Food FM. Each week, we explore the wonderful world of wine, spirits and beer, all things that make wonderful pairings with cheese, of course. We hear from those for whom making drinks is a passion. So after your cheese course, how about you join me for a few drinks? You can find The Drinking Hour with David Kermode on your usual podcast platform and at foodfmradio.com. Now it's back to Jenny and a slice of cheese.
Well, this week on A Slice of Cheese, welcoming back an old friend of the podcast, Patrick McGuigan, cheese writer, author of a wonderful cheese book called The Philosophy of Cheese, which is sort of short but brilliant. So, hello, Patrick.
Oh, hi, Jenny. That's very kind of you to say that. Thank you very much.
No, I love that book because it's very clever. I mean, you cover a lot of ground, but very in a really succinct and witty way, which is so really... Yeah, so in fact, this week, Patrick, the reason I invited you on the show was that we're exploring the idea of a cheese vocabulary, the words we use about cheese. And I thought it'd be really good to talk to a cheese writer. And I was really interested in your thoughts as someone who writes about cheese. What do you feel, you know, do you have a great... Is there a wonderful world of cheese vocabulary, or are there constraints? Or, you know, tell me some of your thoughts as a cheese writer.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, I'm... I write for newspapers and magazines, and you know, I wrote the book, and I sort of spend an inordinate amount of my time trying to describe the flavour and texture of cheese in words. And what I find quite interesting was when I speak to people in the cheese world, or I speak to cheesemakers or cheesemongers, it's in many ways it's quite limited the way people describe cheese. So you hear a lot. The two words that I hear all the time, Jenny, are creamy and nutty. So I can go up. I can go up to a cheese counter, you know, a brilliant cheesemonger, and I'll say, "Tell me about this little goat's cheese here. This little fresh goat's cheese." They'll say, "Oh, it's very creamy. It's got this lovely nutty quality. Oh, that sounds lovely. What about this you know, honking big bit of blue cheese over here? You know, that's going to blow the back of my head off." Yeah, this one's really nutty and really creamy. And you think, hang on a minute. Not all cheeses are creamy and nutty. And interestingly, when you research websites, you know, when I'll be looking up a cheesemaker's website, and creamy and nutty. And the other word that always comes up is mellow. And I have no idea what mellow tastes like. I suppose it's sort of, you know, inoffensive is kind of what they're saying.
Yes, I mean, not astringent. Isn't that interesting? Presumably that... Probably those are words that people think are positive. I mean, you know, if you're a cheesemonger, you know, that you'd see that that's a way in. And perhaps it's not a scary word. I mean, do you think people... That's really interesting, isn't it? Because cheese is such a complex food. They say mini cheeses. And say people who are, you know, who are having to try something the first time, what do you say to them to try and pull them in? Perhaps you do use a bland... Perhaps you then get pushed into this rather neutral vocabulary.
Yeah, I think it's about... marketing, and also creamy and nutty is not wrong, you know, a lot of the time, you know, those are common flavors that you find in cheese. But I think actually you can pull customers in by being more descriptive. So let's take creamy, right? Yeah. So, you know, a lot of cheeses are creamy by their very nature, you know, they're made of milk.
Yeah.
But actually what I think a lot of the time people are talking about is dairy flavours. So, you know, there's a whole world of dairy flavours. You know, there's milk.
Yeah.
There's cream. There's butter.
Yeah.
There's yogurt.
Yeah.
Creme fraiche. You know, there's different types of butter, for example. So you can have sort of that really cultured butter, salted butter. Yeah. You can have whey butter. You can have rancid butter. You can have brown butter.
Yeah.
You know, so actually, if I went into a shop and someone said to me, well, you know, this cheese has a lovely sort of brown butter note. It's like caramelized, but I'm actually more interested to buy the cheese. I have to make it clear here, Jenny, that I'm as guilty of this as everyone else. And so when I'm writing an article, I will always go through my article several times, you know, to check for typos and spellings. And I'll find myself crossing out creamy and nutty several times because I find myself using them as well. And then I'll rethink, I'll go back and taste the cheese and say, well, actually, is it cream?
Yeah.
Okay, yes, maybe it is, but is it double cream? Or clotted cream, or sour cream. You know, there's various creams.
Yes. That's, and especially so, nutty. Nutty could be, you know, hazelnutty or almonds, couldn't you? Or peanutty, you know. I mean,
well, jelly
peanuts
under the
nut before you go down there, but yes.
I was doing a tasting the other day with some cheesemongers, actually, and we were talking about nutty. And I was saying that perhaps one of the things we should do before we start a cheese tasting is to do a nut tasting beforehand. Mm. And we have an array of, you know, we have a peanut, some peanuts, some macadamias, some pistachios, some cashews, some Brazils. Taste through them, get our heads around the flavour of nuts then taste the cheeses, because a roasted hazelnut is very different to a fresh hazelnut, is very different to a pistachio. So I'm going to branch out into the world of nut tasting. That's my
excellent.
New
I look forward to hearing all about, you know, Patrick's description, you know, of a cheese with, you know, next of pistachio in it. So
maybe I'll become a nut writer. I don't know. Yes. Who knows where it might end up.
I'll try and interview you. I'll set up a podcast. So, I mean, in fact, and I was also thinking when you talked about macadamias, what I was thinking about macadamias is this is the texture, isn't it? They've got that very waxy texture.
Yes.
And actually texture is such a massive bit. If you're trying to describe cheese, you then hit, I mean, what's fascinating about cheese is the range of textures. But again, it does feel like perhaps our vocabulary, you know, perhaps we don't have enough words for the type of textures. Because, you know, if you think about soft cheese, don't you think this, Patrick? You know, there's soft cheese, but within that one adjective, which is sort of accurate, but yet, you know, same in a world of textures within that, isn't there?
Absolutely. And actually, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, texture in cheese is fundamental in a way. If I compare it to wine, for example, you know, so I've done a lot on wine tasting and I've done qualifications in wine and the overlap between wine and cheese in terms of flavour is really interesting. There is a lot of overlap. But with texture, you know, there is texture in wine. You know, you have body and richness. But I would say in cheese, it's much more important in terms of the eating experience. I mean, I would go to as far to say is, you know, it's sort of 30%, 40% of the enjoyment of the cheese is actually how it feels in your mouth, as much as the flavour, which I think is unusual, you know, for a food type. It's sort of an integral part of it. And
you're absolutely, it's that, you know, you're right, it's that multiplicity of, this is, you know, this is why you and I are fascinated by cheese. It's, you know, we use the one word. And yes, it's sort of one food, but it sort of isn't, because it's got so many forms and expressions, hasn't it? So, yeah.
That thing with soft cheese, you were saying, is it, so I teach the Academy of Cheese, level one and level two, where we go into lots of tasting. Mm-hmm. And the first cheese I always taste on level one is a goat's curd. It's sort of the simplest sort of soft cheese you can find. You know, you make a curd, you salt it, and then you sell it, essentially. But what's fascinating is when you taste that cheese, you know, never mind about the flavour, but the texture, we end up often with my students, you know, teach the course online or in a classroom, is we often end up spending like 20 minutes just talking about the texture of a simple curd. Words like come up, things like fluffy or whipped or light or moussey or, you know, it sort of, claggy is another word that someone brought up recently, which was a real sort of, I think that's quite a northern, north of England word, claggy, for a goat's curd that wasn't really fluffy. It was a bit, it was almost too moist. But yeah, brilliant array of words. And again, going back to selling cheese, you know, if you're on a counter or you're writing a website or a brochure for your product, I think, you know, you could describe your goat's cheese as a soft goat's cheese. Or you could describe your goat cheese as having a light whipped cream texture. Mm. I know which one I'm going to be more interested in as a consumer. So, you know, using vocabulary well and having a wide range of vocabulary is not just to sort of show off and to have sort of interesting foodie chats with people. It's actually about really summing up the character of a cheese properly. And then also being able to convey that and interest people in the cheese itself. So, it is important, I think, the words we use.
Yeah, very important. I mean, so do you feel, because you talked about your wine education you've had, do you think the world of, you know, in a way we thought about, people have been sort of writing about wine and thinking about how to describe it, it feels for a long, you know, for a long time. And do you think is it better equipped than the world of cheese?
I think, well, there's the Wine and Spirits Education Trust, which is sort of the benchmark system of qualifications for wine, has been around a long, long time, and is a global system that I think, you know, literally tens of thousands of people take the qualifications each year, if not hundreds of thousands. So they're a bit further down the road, if you like, in this world of, you know, structured approaches to tasting wine and so on. But the Academy of Cheese, which I mentioned before, you know, has been going 5 or 6 years now and has a similar approach to sort of tasting cheese in a structured way. And so I think it is developing and becoming more of a global language, if you like.
One other thing that sort of struck me
is that when I look at cheese and the Academy model and the Wine and Spirits Education Trust model, there's quite a lot of overlap in terms of the sort of words used. It's really trying to describe cheese or wine by referencing other flavours, like known flavours, if you like.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
You know, a cheese could taste of, I don't know, parsley or grass or mint or something. So mm-hmm. you're using other foods to describe cheese. And that also happens in wine. You know, you talk about strawberry
asparagus,
asparagus or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Quite.
But there's a few people I've spoken to in the cheese world who there's a couple of cheese makers I've spoken to who tend to look at the flavour of cheese in more in terms of shape, which is quite interesting. So they'll talk about sort of round flavours or spiky flavours.
Yeah.
Or it sort of stretches out. It's got, you know, the flavour stretches out and then hits a wall, or there's an angle, or it's interesting, and I can sort of understand what they mean is that, you know, when you taste the cheese, you often go on a journey with it. You know, the flavours develop and change in, as you chew and they develop in your mouth. And sometimes I find myself using sort of the idea of almost like a visual interpretation of flavour rather than just trying to think of other flavours. It's to think of it in a different way, which I think sometimes I use that more when I'm sort of talking to people. And I do notice in tasting stuff, people get what you mean when you talk about it really, you know, it's really round flavour, or it's got a spike in the middle, or it's very flat. Yeah, so, I mean, you know, it's a philosophical point, isn't it, you know?
I mean, I suppose, you know, because you're teaching, Patrick, I mean, when you're teaching, your students are trying to verbalise what they're tasting. So it must be interesting listening to what the words they come up with. And I'm guessing, I mean, do you get a lot of the same... Do you get the same words, or is it really vary with, you know, with people?
It's really interesting. So I would say when you're teaching a room full of British people, you know, that a lot of the words that come up are quite similar and quite familiar. I teach the Academy of Cheese course online, and it's open. We do webinars and it's open to anyone in the world. And I've had people joining me from Nigeria, from Canada, from Singapore, Australia, you know, France, Germany, Hong Kong, India. And what's interesting, particularly I was thinking more with that sort of the students that join me from the East, you know, from say from China and India, that they will often have different references. So where I'll be talking about a cheese tasting very savoury and reminding me of, say, Bovril, which you know is a sort of familiar sort of childhood flavor almost for me.
Yeah.
They will be talking about things like, you know, I've had people describe cheese as tasting of kimchi and fish sauce.
Yes.
And foods actually that I've never heard of. And I'm like, I don't know that food.
Yeah.
But you know, and again, when you think about it, there are a lot, you know, say with fish sauce, there is a kind of savory umami quality to fish sauce, which actually when they said it to me, I was like, yeah, that's really good. That's actually really, but it's not a description I would have used, because
your normal reference frame, isn't it?
In terms of my sort of cultural upbringing.
Yeah,
I mean, when I was a child, we weren't eating lots of food with fish sauce in, so
yeah,
I think that's quite interesting. So I do think a lot of how we describe flavour and how we taste is influenced by our culture and the context of where we grew up and what we eat on a day-to-day basis.
And to go back, Patrick, to that point you were making, in a way, if you look at cheesemakers' website, often there's very little detailed description, I find, because, you know, often I have to use them as a research tool. You know, I'm trying to write something, I want to check something, I want to be reminded what that was like. And then you're like, oh, okay, all they've given me is the weight and the some facts about it. But yeah, but the description, which I'm guessing perhaps it's just perhaps people find it a tricky area, but often it will, you know, you won't get much description of the flavour or the texture. You'll get a very, quite cursory or brief descriptions. So it's nice to me when you were saying you felt like there's an opportunity in a way that the cheese world could be doing a better job in a way of describing what cheese is.
Yeah, I think so. I think that, I mean, it's interesting because I visit cheesemakers all the time for articles, and, you know, they'll wax lyrical about, you know, the starter cultures they use and the temperature they're scalding the curd at and all that sort of stuff. And at the end of it, you know, we usually sit down and try some of the cheese. And, you know, I don't want to sit there and, you know, tell them what I think of their cheese. You know, I figure they're going to know their cheese better than, you know, anything I can say. But quite often when I say, well, what, you know, how would you describe your cheese? You know, what sort of flavours do you think? They're very like, oh, I don't know. I wouldn't like to say, really. They're quite modest about it. And I wonder, I'm not sure what that is. I think that's partly perhaps a kind of British reserve that they don't want to seem to be showing off about their cheese or something.
Yeah, I think you're right. A lot of cheesemakers are remarkably modest, aren't they? But also I think they're, you know, in Britain, we're not encouraged really to describe, you know, I think it's this whole thing of our food culture in Britain isn't as rooted as it is in some other countries. And so I think, you know, we're not, that whole thing of talking about food and then let alone sort of trying to describe it, I think perhaps it's just seen as a little bit pretentious or out of your comfort zone, maybe it would be more correct.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think there's a concern not to be seen as being pretentious, which I think's really interesting because, you know, that's not something that has affected the wine world. you know, wine descriptions are as complex and long-winded as you like, and a lot of the time the wine doesn't live up to the description on the back of the
bottle.
That's
very interesting. That seems in a way, it's a funny way, isn't it? So perhaps excessive modesty with cheese, but then, you know, so we might just say it's nice, you know, this is creamy, and then you eat it, you're like, oh, that's amazing. That's a better response. I was actually thinking, Patrick, because I've done a lot of chocolate writing and that whole chocolates, you know, and lots of chocolate judging and again, it's a very, you know, chocolate is a sort of fascinating. It's got so many different flavours within it. And I made that chocolate world, again, seems pretty, rather like the wine world, I think, is quite confident about, you know, detecting notes and flavours and interests. And they're very upfront about it. So perhaps our final thought should be a rallying cry to the world of cheese. You know, look at chocolate, look at wine. Cheese is a wonderful food. Let's try and enrich how we describe it.
Absolutely, I would fully agree with that. Stop being so shy, cheesemakers. Come on, show off a bit. You've got an amazing product that's absolutely packed full of flavour and texture. You know, sell it a bit. I don't think you should be too retiring in that respect.
Perfect.
Shout it loud from the cheese counter, I say.
Excellent. Good. Oh, brilliant, Patrick. Well, Patrick, it's such a joy to talk to you as ever. A real pleasure. So thank you for your time.
Thanks very much. Cheers, Jenny. Bye. Bye.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.
Enhance your cheese board with Peter's Yard sourdough crackers this Christmas. Available at Waitrose, Sainsbury's, Morrison's, Ocado, Amazon, petersyard.com and specialist food retailers.
Thank you so much for listening to A Slice of Cheese. I hope you've enjoyed it. If you have enjoyed it, it would be lovely if you could rate us on wherever you've found this podcast. It will make such a difference to us. So I hope you'll enjoy us again. Thank you very much.